Welcome to episode 119 of the Fertility Podcast. I'm Natalie, your host. And if this is your first listen, welcome. I hope you find some answers to, I'm sure, some of the many questions you have. If you are looking via thefertilitypodcast.com, the podcasts are in different sections, or there's a search bar, so you can type it in there and hopefully you'll find whether I've covered it. If I haven't, do let me know. My contact details will be at the end of this episode. If you found me in iTunes, all the episodes are there. And thank you so much for the reviews that you've been leaving. I've been asking of late for you to rate and review this podcast, because it helps it stay prominent when people are searching for this type of subject matter. And you've been saying lovely things. And if you haven't yet had time to rate and review this podcast in iTunes, it would be amazing if you could. Now, we're going to be talking about egg freezing in this episode. Maybe it's somewhere that you're at, maybe it's something that you're thinking about. And it's especially prominent because this year, 2018, we'll see the first bout of women who froze their 10 years ago in the UK have to use them or let them just be disposed of, which is quite a lot to get head around. And I wanted to speak to an expert about it, which is what you'll hear. And also we're going to be speaking to an artist who has a play in the UK happening this week. I'm speaking to you at the end of January, and it is actually going on tour. You'll hear all about it, and it's about her kind of realization at 35 of what she was wanting to do, have a baby or not. So as always, make yourself comfortable and plug yourself in. If you're on the move, then just enjoy what you're about to hear. I'm now going to welcome Zeynep Girtin to the podcast, who is a senior research associate at the London Women's Clinic, which is here in the UK. And she's been working on egg freezing and how women feel about egg freezing, as well as having her own experiences to share. Zeynep, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I'm really interested to learn more about you and your experience. First of all, from a personal point of view, because you made the decision to freeze your eggs, didn't you?
I did, yes. I froze my eggs last year. So my background is in academia. I joined the London Women's Clinic in October 2016. Before that, I was an academic researcher based at the University of Cambridge. And since I started my graduate studies in 2003, which is a pretty long time ago now, all of my research and work has been focused on various aspects of what we call the sociology of reproduction, or the sociology of assisted reproduction. So some of my work was about how couples feel about IVF, going through the IVF process. I've worked on egg sharing and how eggshare donors and eggshare recipients feel about each other. I've worked on what we call cross-border reproductive care, you know, how people feel about having to travel abroad to access various reproductive technologies for cost reasons or whatever. So I've kind of looked at various different areas within this world. And it's only in the last few years that I've really been focusing on egg freezing.
Because what I'm interested to talk about, and I have focused on egg freezing before on this podcast, is whether women really understand the implications, I suppose, behind it. Because I think there is the assumption that this is a bit of a failsafe, that you freeze your eggs and then you're guaranteed a baby. And from your work, I know that you're keen to emphasize that it's not that straightforward, aren't you?
Yes. I think if we look at any fertility treatment, one of the central things to note about it is that it is not a guarantee. And that's from the most straightforward IVF process to, you know, the more complicated, you know, egg donation process, and certainly for egg freezing. There is no guarantee with these technologies. It's not a case of, you know, 1 + 1 = 2. It's a case where sometimes the clinic and the embryologists and the doctors will do the exact same thing and it will work and it will result in a pregnancy. And sometimes it won't. But that's partly because the underlying mechanism of reproduction itself is not 100%. So I think it's really important to be aware right from the outset with all of these technologies that they don't offer guarantees, that they can't be 100%. So they will work for some people and they won't work for other people. And obviously, as the science progresses, as the protocols develop, hopefully those odds are going to increase and they'll be more successful for more people. But I don't think it's a situation where these things can ever be 100%.
Now, you shared with me a really lovely short film, which I will put on the show notes for this episode. And it was telling the tale of a woman who had decided to freeze her eggs, having come out of a relationship and wanted to still empower herself about her future motherhood opportunities, let's say. And I think that that was a really interesting viewpoint on it for people thinking about this and understanding the decision that women make to freeze their eggs. And I'm interested just to hear a bit about how you felt going through that experience and making the decision to freeze your eggs.
Well, it's interesting. As part of my work here at the London Women's Clinic, I've been talking to lots and lots and lots of women who are choosing to freeze their eggs, who have already frozen their eggs, or who are thinking about whether to freeze their eggs or not. And, you know, there are certain patterns. Obviously, every case is an individual, but there are certain patterns. So predominantly, the kinds of women who come to freeze their eggs are, they're single, they really want to be a mother, they're not in a position right now to be able to have the family they wanted because they're not in a relationship or they're not in the right relationship. And so this is something they're doing, and a lot of them will use the words, you know, to buy myself a little bit more time or something like that. And that tends to be kind of the most common situation. A lot of those women will have recently come out of relationships in which they thought they were going to have children and marriage or whatever. And for one reason or another, that hasn't transpired. But my story was a little bit different, I guess. I was married. I was married very young, at 24. And I think for me, having a family and being a mother was always sort of something that I, not just something that I assumed would happen, but something that was very, very important to me. You know, I've always loved children. I'm very good with children, you know, all of that. And so, yeah, I was married at a very young age and then also divorced at a very young age. So I was divorced at 31. And one of the first, or one of the strongest senses of sadness associated with that divorce was the idea that this family, which I had thought was imminent, had suddenly, you know, completely disappeared from the horizon. And I thought, my God, you know, what can I do? And at that, I'm now 38, we're talking 7 years ago. At that time, instinctively, what I wanted to do was check my fertility. You know, am I fertile? Can I have a child? Okay, it's not happening right now, but will I be able, do I still have that option in a few years' time, maybe when I meet someone else? And at that time, fertility MOTs were not a big thing. So, you know, I went to my GP and my GP did us, you know, a couple of tests and said, you know, oh, you're fine, go away. But, you know, it's quite interesting that at that time, it wasn't in the news. It was a big thing for me. I wanted to find out, like, have I completely missed out on the opportunity for motherhood, or do I still have some years? Fast forward some years of, you know, terrible dating experiences with inappropriate men for various reasons. And then 2.5 years ago, I met my current partner, who, you know, I'm very much in love with, and he's wonderful. But, you know, we arrived at that relationship in from very different perspectives. I arrived at that relationship thinking, fantastic, I've now met, you know, the man of my dreams, let's just go ahead and have a family right away. And he arrived at that relationship thinking, you know, I'm really not sure I want to have a family. So in my case, egg freezing was about just giving ourselves a third option. Okay. Yeah, because I think within a relationship, that's a very, very difficult disagreement to encounter, you know, because there is no midway. You can't have half a baby.
Sure.
So in a relationship, if you have one person that really wants to have children and the other person that is completely unsure or doesn't want to have children, it's very, very difficult. So what do? You completely quit the relationship and say, okay, fine, you know, let's go our separate ways, or let's buy ourselves a little bit more time and, you know, allow ourselves to think through this together for a little bit longer. And as a 37-year-old woman, I sort of thought, if we are going to give ourselves a bit more time to think about this, I really want to put a few eggs away.
So just explain, being 37, making that decision, is there a check on your egg health in that process? Because women constantly told, oh, 35, you know, the clock's ticking and egg health and fertility declines. So if a woman is past 35 and is getting to nearer to her 40s, are those conversations had in the clinic? What information are you given?
Yeah, of course. So there are, you know, population averages regarding fertility decline. And we do know, you know, a woman starts to lose her eggs from, you know, even before she's born. So even by the time you're 30, you only have a small percentage of your eggs left. And certainly after 35, your egg reserve is declining. And if you see these graphs, there's this sort of precipitous falling off a cliff around 37. But that doesn't really give us detailed information about particular individuals. So we do have women who come to the clinic wanting to freeze their eggs, who are in their very late 30s, who have a fertility MOT and find out, great, you know, they have good ovarian reserve. They can quite reasonably go through a cycle of egg freezing and expect to get, you know, a reasonable number of eggs. But we also have much younger women who are having a fertility MOT preemptively, just to see where they are, who find out that their ovarian reserve is very, very compromised. And, you know, if they want to do anything, they have to do it now. So there is a huge variation within a population with regards to where a woman's egg reserves will be. And that's the very first thing that will happen. If any woman who comes in considering about freezing her eggs, the first step will be to have a detailed fertility MOT. And that fertility MOT is what's going to, the results of that fertility MOT is what will give her specific results regarding how she'll respond to a cycle of ovarian stimulation, how many eggs she can expect to get from one cycle, and what kinds of potential success rates for the future that might represent in terms of, you know, having a live baby at some point in the future.
Now, let's talk about some of the open evenings that you've observed, the different types of women coming in to find out more. And I'm also then interested in, if they've made the decision to freeze their eggs, how many are coming back to actually use those frozen eggs. So first of all, let's just talk about those different types of women, because making that decision is much more accepted than it ever has been. And we're raising the awareness by talking about it now. But there are concerns, aren't there, that people have, like, would it be fair for them to do it on their own? And what if they're then in a relationship and the other person thinks they're a bit weird to have done it?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing to note is that we are seeing an unprecedented number of women now who are in their late 30s, who are childless and don't want to remain childless for the rest of their lives, so who are involuntarily childless and who feel that potentially reproductive medicine offers them some options. So one option to address that might be to try and conceive a baby using donor sperm. If you're single and you know that you really want to be a mother and you don't want to miss out on that, that's one option. Freezing your eggs is another option. So I do see quite a large number of women who come to the clinic who will say, you know, who'll be, for example, a woman who's 40 who'll come in and say, listen, I gave myself until I was 40. And I said to myself, if I'm not with a partner by the time I'm 40, I'm going to go ahead and do this on my own. And now I'm trying to decide whether I should use donor sperm to have a baby or whether I should freeze my eggs and maybe give myself a couple of more years. But what these women have in common is that they, in an unprecedented way right now, they have these technological possibilities that are slightly, you know, extending the options, the choices that are available to them. With that also comes, you know, greater responsibility and greater burden of responsibility. So certainly some of the women who are thinking about using donor sperm are concerned about what it means to have a child without a father. Is that fair on a child? Now, I have to say that the psychological research, the longitudinal research, much of which has been done at the Centre for Family Research in Cambridge, which follows various different family forms that have been conceived using assisted reproduction, including, you know, what are called single mothers by choice, is overwhelmingly positive. You know, these children, whether we're talking about single women using donor sperm or lesbian couples using donor sperm or a couple who has a fertility problem using donor eggs or donor sperm, you know, these are very, very much desired children. And so their outcomes tend to be very positive. And a lot of that research just shows that it's not really the, you know, the number of parents or the gender of the parents. It's to do with the style of parenting, the parental warmth that that shows those outcomes. So I do try to reassure those women with regards to that concern. And a lot of those women who are considering using donor sperm, you know, they've thought about things so carefully. They've set themselves up, not just, you know, practically and financially, to be able to deal with being a single parent, but also they've discussed this with their friends and their family. And, you know, I was talking with a woman just the other day who her baby has three godfathers who are, you know, three very different men of slightly different age groups, because she really wanted to ensure that he would have you know, male role models in his life.
Well, I spoke in a previous episode about co-parenting and how that is a way in which people are deciding to have families. And I think it's fascinating. I think, you know, the more variety of input, if you are going on a more unconventional route to become a parent, it can only be a positive thing because you're thinking about it so much more than, say, your average couple may do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's just things are changing so much right now. The days when, you know, the 2.4 children with a genetically related mother and father being the family form and, you know, that being the norm and the kind of the only family out there, that's just no longer the case. There are so many different kinds of families. And I think there's much more acceptance. There's much more social acceptance for that. And I think it's a really, really good thing that people have the opportunity to form the families that they wish and that are going to work for them.
Now, let's just talk about this whole storage time limit on frozen eggs, because it's not something that I've covered in the podcast before, and I'm not entirely sure people actually understand it properly, because I was quite surprised when you explained it to me. Just set it out how it works. You freeze your eggs, and then what happens?
So in the UK, all fertility treatments are regulated by the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority, the HFEA, and they have certain rules that all of the clinics have to abide by. One of those rules is that the maximum storage period for frozen eggs is 10 years. So if a woman freezes her eggs today, where are we, January 2018, those eggs can only be stored until January 2028, regardless of what age she is right now or whether she manages to have children in those interim 10 years or not. So once those 10 years are up, if the eggs have not been used, the technical term is they have to be taken out and allowed to perish. This is problematic for several reasons. First reason is that it's a disincentive. If you can only freeze your eggs for 10 years, it is a disincentive to freeze your eggs when you're younger. At the time when you're likely to get the healthiest eggs and when your body is likely to respond best to treatment. I mean, ideally, egg freezing technology would work best if women were freezing their eggs in their early 30s or late 20s. You know, you'd get very healthy eggs, you'd get a good number of eggs, you could just do the one cycle, put it aside. But right now, of course, in the UK, I would never recommend a woman to freeze her eggs in her late 20s because she would have to thaw them by the time she's in her late 30s. It's not actually giving her much extra time at all. The other issue is that women in the UK are allowed to receive fertility treatment using donor eggs until the age of 54. So if you froze your eggs when you were 39, you would have to take them out and allow them to perish by the time you're 49, although you could technically still use donor eggs for another 5 years, which seems very illogical. There is a lot of discussion right now about the fact that this law, this 10-year limit, is not fit for purpose. It's not serving the women who want to freeze their eggs very well. It doesn't really fit with the way the technology works. I think it's going to take a while to try and get enough momentum to even have discussions about changing this law. But this is something definitely that we're interested in doing.
As far as where we are today with women who may have been proactive and had frozen their eggs 10 years ago, I mean, that realisation must, if they're not ready to use those eggs, what kind of support do they get? Because they're going to have to, I suppose, deal with the fact that this kind of proactive measure that they took is now almost useless.
I think it's a really, really painful situation to be in. So right now, because egg freezing using vitrification, which is what we use now, only really started in the UK around 2007, 2008. At the London Women's Clinic, we started egg freezing in 2008. At the Bridge Centre, which we work with, they started in 2007. That's some of the very first cases in the country. So we're really seeing the very first cohort of women right now, in few numbers, who are coming to the end of their 10-year storage limit. For those women, it's a really horrible, horrible situation to be in. Because as you say, this measure that they took, it is suddenly causing distress and confusion and uncertainty, rather than actually being this, you know, safety net that they'd hoped it would be. 10 years sounds like a long time, But who knows what's happened in these women's lives in those 10 years, or why they haven't used the eggs yet, or when they might plan to use them. And we've got a research study right now that's going to be looking specifically at that. So we're going to be looking at the views and experiences of the women who are coming towards the end of their storage period, trying to understand how they feel about it, and, you know, how those 10 years have passed, and just trying to kind of understand a little bit more about the ways in which this sort of slightly arbitrary and illogical 10-year limit is potentially having a very negative impact on women's lives.
Well, we should definitely speak again when you've got more of that data so that we
can talk it through. Yeah, absolutely. I think it's going to be really interesting.
But for people listening, because ultimately we do want to empower women being able to have access to this technology, and it goes hand in hand with the education and the awareness and the understanding of what's involved. I mean, what would you say to somebody listening who is at a crossroads, they've been trying to decide, you know, what they're going to do next when it comes to making the decision to freeze their eggs with this 10-year timeline hanging over them?
I mean, I think with all of these technologies, I wouldn't want to singularly sort of advocate for them. You know, sure. They're great for some people. They're absolutely not right for other people. And let's also just acknowledge the fact that these technologies are very expensive right now. So they're just absolutely inaccessible to a very large number of women also, which is, you know, it's a huge problem. But even for women who can afford it, you know, for some of those women, it will be the right thing to do. For others, it just won't be the right thing to do. And the way to ascertain that is to allow yourself time to think about it, to get information, and to, you know, discuss it with the people around you whose opinions matter to you, or who know you well and who can, you know, who can help you think through these things. I think it's incredibly important to talk about these issues more. And, you know, that's something I'm very passionate about doing. You mentioned the open evenings and the seminars. That's a part of my job that I absolutely love. We do these free seminars, and I have one that's especially for single women called Fertility Options for Single Women, which covers, you know, what happens in a fertility MOT. It covers, you know, all the pros and cons and different issues related to egg freezing. And it also discusses, you know, the various different aspects of conception using donor sperm. You know, those are a really good opportunity to sit in a room with other women who are in a similar situation, to discuss these issues in a very sort of non-judgmental and open atmosphere, where all different reactions and all different emotions are very, very welcome. And, you know, really try and use that space to think through some of the possible implications or thoughts that one might have. So it's really about, I wouldn't want to say to any particular woman, you know, yay, go ahead, do this, or, you know, don't do this. It's very, very individual. The women I speak with, by and large, they're all very intelligent. They're all very realistic. You know, women don't go into this with their eyes closed. Most women do realize that egg freezing is not a guarantee. You know, sometimes there are older women whose ovarian reserve is already diminished, and they know that even if they go through a cycle of egg freezing, they're going to only get around, you know, 3 or 4 eggs, which is not very many. But they're sort of sanguine about that. And they say, well, you know that the chances aren't high, but for me, it's important to know that I've done this. It will mean something to me to have done this. And I think that's also important too. It's a very individual decision that women have to make. But what I would say is go and try and get information from impartial sources, because it is obviously a commercial market, and allow yourself time to make the decision that's going to be the right one for you.
And just finally, I mean, last year, the end of last year, I remember seeing the story about Rita Ora freezing her eggs. What do you think about these kind of celebrity reveals on matters like this? Do you think they're beneficial or not?
Well, I think it depends a little bit on how it's framed. I actually wrote an article about the Rita Ora case for The Independent. The problem with the Rita Ora case was, you know, she froze her eggs when she was 26. And, you know, we just don't know whether she froze her eggs for health reasons or whether she froze her eggs outside of the UK. But in the aftermath of that news story, we did get quite a few inquiries from women in their 20s at the clinic. And I just had to say to all of them, look, you know, there is this 10-year limit. You do not want to be thinking about freezing your eggs when you're 26, because you'd have to thaw them by the time you're 36. So you wouldn't really be achieving anything. You wouldn't be buying yourself extra time. But more broadly, I think, you know, women talking about freezing their eggs, it's a good thing. I think there's a lot of you know, there's a lot of stigma associated with all of this, or, you know, even the idea that there are women in their late 30s who are baby hungry or whatever. It's just, you know, it's very derogatory. It's very unnecessary. So to actually talk about these issues and to get rid of the stigma, I think generally very, very good. Yeah, I would encourage more of that.
Let's just also be clear on the kind of cost aspect to it. And I know costs vary. Can you give me a ballpark figure of one cycle to freeze your eggs? Because it's also important that people understand that if you freeze your egg and you're intending to use that as your route to parenthood, you are then going to have to pay for fertility treatment, which is a cost to consider later on.
Doing one cycle of egg freezing, I believe it's going to cost between £3,500 to £5,000. You know, that's, and it will, the cost will vary depending on how much drugs you have to use. Obviously, the more drugs, the more expensive. But that's sort of the ballpark, £3,500 to £5,000.
The best case scenario is that you conceive naturally and it's money that you spend to cover yourself in case.
Absolutely. That would be my wish for everybody, you know, is that they freeze these eggs, they put them aside, they give themselves a bit of peace of mind or whatever it was they wanted to get out of the process. And then they end up having, you know, the families that they wanted when they wanted, and that they don't actually have to resort to this. Best case scenario, you will have wasted £5,000.
Let's say invested in yourself rather than
invested
wasted.
In yourself, that's right.
Yeah, it's a very expensive beauty treatment that, yes, you didn't then necessarily have to use.
I have spoken to a lot of women who've said that after freezing their eggs, the way they've approached dating or the way they've approached their lives has changed. So they have, so in a way, it has really been an investment, regardless of whether, you know, those eggs then turn into babies. It's allowed them to alleviate anxiety, or it's allowed them to be able to date in a way where it's become more enjoyable rather than kind of this hurried search for a, you know, future father for your children or something like that, which you know, in itself is a valuable thing.
And it provides a fascinating conversation to have with a new person that you're dating, male or female, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Well, Zeynep, it's been fascinating chatting to you. We're going to put the links to the London Women's Clinic, that video I mentioned, and some of the other articles that you've written that are really interesting. And let's keep in touch about the survey that you're currently doing, because I'd be really keen to hear more outcomes on that.
Thank you very much, Natalie.
All right.
Bye.
Bye. Mind-bogglingly fascinating stuff there from Zeynep. And before we speak to my next guest, here's a quick note from my sponsors. The Fertility Podcast is supported by Ovusense. If you're trying to monitor your cycle and finding it overwhelming, Ovusense is the only ovulation monitor on the market that is a Class 2 medical device. It has a vaginal sensor and app and fits like a tampon, so it's really easy to use and comfortable to wear. Now, you use it at night while you sleep, and then in the morning, you simply remove, wash it, and download your data to see your cycle pattern. Now, Ovusense has proven comfortable for women in over 10,000 cycles of use, and can predict ovulation up to a day in advance, and can confirm it with 99% accuracy. To find out more, visit ovusense.com. The Fertility Podcast is also supported by IVF Matters, the UK's first online fertility clinic, where you can order tests delivered to your door, have scans at multiple locations, and speak to consultants in the comfort of your own home. It's a truly unique way to experience your fertility journey, and you can find out more at ivfmatters.co.uk or call 0333 939951. So I'm now going to welcome Joanne Ryan, who is about to start a run of her play Existentialism in a London theatre, which she's going to tell us more about. Joanne, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Natalie.
And we're speaking at the end of January in 2018, and your play is about to run. I know you've already performed it, and I'm sure we'll be continuing to, but I found you online, as I love finding people, and wanted to know more. It's quite a personal story. Tell me how it came to be.
Well, I was part of a theatre incubation scheme, which is like a development scheme, a few years ago. I was working with a UK company called Theatre Uncut. They make political theatre. So I knew going into it that I was going to write something political, but I didn't know what. And on the first day, as an icebreaker, they asked us to rant for 1 minute about something that we were angry about or afraid of. And so I did my rant. And then at the end, as a joke, I said, and I don't know whether or not I should have a baby. And then the room kind of went quiet and everyone burst out laughing. And then I realized that the joke was on me because it was true. And I sort of had been putting it out of my mind. And I was about to turn 35 a couple of days later. which is sort of the famous age where your fertility kind of falls off a cliff, we're told, as women. So suddenly, all of a sudden, was this big issue in my life, and I hadn't given it any thought, really, and I didn't have a clue. I didn't feel any different physically, mentally, emotionally, psychologically than I had really 10 years earlier. But suddenly, I felt like I was under pressure to make this big decision. So I decided that that is what the play would be about, and that hopefully the journey of researching it forensically would help me come to a decision myself. But I was also very aware early on that it was a deeply political decision in lots of ways, and it was very fraught, and that I was part of the first generation of humans in the world to actually have a choice. I mean, certainly in Ireland, like when my mum got pregnant with me, in 1979, contraceptives were still illegal in Ireland. So she didn't have a choice. My grandmother certainly didn't. So I felt like I was part of this interesting kind of experimental cohort of people who had a choice for the first time in histories of the species, but didn't have a blueprint of how that behaviour or how that could look like. You know, if I was to make the choice not to, there was no role models anywhere of what that might look like or how I could have a happy, fulfilling, full life, you know, without a child. So, yeah, I just became really, really interested in documenting the whole thing.
Well, I mean, it sounds completely fascinating where it's led you, and the fact that you've said how we're this generation that have a choice. Whilst we do, I think society still assumes that we'll go the traditional way. So even if we make that choice, how we're perceived is still so confused by others, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, no, absolutely, because we're the first. So you're sort of blazing a trail in lots of ways if you decide not to. And in Ireland, and particularly everything, I mean, this is something that came up in interviews I did. I ended up doing a lot of interviews with people and researched the show for about 2 years before I performed it. And I spoke to social scientists and social historians and stuff, and social psychologists, and they talked a lot about how cultural events were very focused around family. Yeah, that everything was, you know, to be part of the culture, particularly in rural areas, less so in urban areas, but still to a large degree, things were very family focused, and, you know, the culture was very much geared up that way. So, yeah, there's a lot of pressure and a lot of expectation.
Now, you said you spent a good 2 years doing this research. What did you say to people? You were writing a play and you were just keen to know.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you can get away with loads if you're writing a play. You're not a crazy woman. You're just being thorough. So I got to speak to loads of doctors, gynecologists, fertility experts, like I was saying, social scientists, social workers, social historians, loads of really interesting people. Yeah, it was fascinating. And then also just lots of friends, family, peers, you know, people who had chosen not to or who couldn't or who did or, you know, and just to find out what they felt they would be gained and lost either way.
Well, let's talk a bit more first about some of the stuff you found out, because one of the things you said was that you'd read that 10,000 of a woman's eggs die a day.
And then, yes.
And you'd also talked about how in the early stages of meeting a boyfriend, you declared about getting your eggs counted.
Yes.
So what kind of processes did you go through?
Well, the boyfriend thing was on our third date. So I met my now current boyfriend. We're still together. But at the time, we just met on Tinder. And so on our third date, he's like, so what are you working on at the moment? And I said, well, I'm writing a play about my eggs, but I'm totally sane.
I didn't think you were a chicken farmer or anything.
No. So he decided, his response was brilliant. And his response became an important part of the play, actually, because he said, I think it's really important. I think it's brilliant. And he said, and also, I have to make that decision too. I'm also part of this generation who has a choice. You know, it's not an assumed thing like it was for my father and my grandfather. And I also don't have a clue what I want either. So maybe I don't have the same time pressures as you exactly, but I still do have to make a decision. So he sort of went on the journey with me. So after our third date, I was scheduled to go to a fertility clinic to get my eggs and bits counted and looked at and all that. So he went and did the same in another fertility clinic. And got his sperm counted and stuff. So we were looking at our baby making stats like on our fourth date, basically, which is bizarre. But I thought it was really interesting that that was his perspective, you know. And I wanted the show to be a generational issue, not just a gender issue as well.
Yeah. No, I think it's really
interesting. Because it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
Definitely. Well, I know from doing this podcast, it's a kind of 50-50 issue when it comes to infertility problems, male, female. So the awareness and the empowerment of that awareness, I think, is really important. And I'm interested to know if, whilst you kind of went down this journey in quite a lighthearted way, researching for a play rather than there being an actual problem,
Yes.
If you had found out that there was a problem, because I'm assuming from the way that you're talking that you were told things looked pretty fine and you were probably in a good place, was that the outcome?
Yeah, I mean, I was told that I was normal-ish and, you know, that it would be possible probably, but you never know, and not to wait around too long. But then, of course, I was making the show, so then that was another 2 years, and then the show was very successful, so I'm now touring the show. So, some of my friends were saying, you know, and family as well, that kind of the show in a way has made the decision for you because of its success and it's resonating with people so much, and it's now traveling, you know, doing a lot of international touring and stuff. I've just turned 38. Yesterday was my birthday.
Happy birthday.
You know, so I'm, thank you very much. So I'm sort of coming into that zone of the past 38 that all those doctors 3 years ago told me not to leave it until, because of, in many ways, of the show. Although maybe I'm just using that as an excuse, I don't know. But certainly one of the things that I discovered about through making the play was that there's no correct answer for anybody, and that my life, you know, if I do or if I don't, will just have a different set of problems and successes and joys. You know, they'll just be different, but not, but one won't be better than the other, I suppose. So the sense of peace that realization brought me meant that I didn't feel the same pressure anymore, you know, to figure it out or to decide or to get on it or, you know, all those things, which has been really freeing, actually. And that's feedback that comes back from the show as well when people come to see it in various situations, you know. So people have often wondered, is it right for me because I'm having issues with my fertility or haven't been able to have children, or, you know, people even who've miscarried recently and were wondering would it be something that would be traumatic for them. I found the opposite, that it can be a very peaceful, reassuring thing to watch and, you know, journey to be a part of, I suppose.
Well, talk to me a little bit more about the plot, because it's, as you said, it's not just about the egg freezing situation, it's an awareness that you looked into.
All autobiographical, yeah. So it's about my journey that I took over the course of a year, year and a half, to try and find a way to a decision. So it involves me going to fertility clinics and going to fortune tellers in more desperate moments, going to friends and family who exist in the show and as recorded audio. And also my mother and various other places, the darkest recesses of the internet and other places you go to in the middle of the night when you're really desperate. And my mum is a recurring character in it. So she plays herself in audio recordings throughout.
Great.
She's just sort of being typical Irish mammy, passing remarks on everything. She's turned out to be the absolute hilarious scene-stealing star of the show in lots of ways. But the reason that she's there is to act as an intergenerational link, because I'm telling the story through the prism of the cultural context that I'm making this decision in, which is Ireland's reproductive health history. So we begin the show in 1916, which is the birth of the nation, but also the birth of my granny. And it sort of goes on from there. So the sort of sections of condensed, animated, minutes of Irish history throughout. Very, very short and brief, but just to contextualise all the kind of madcap comedy capers that's going on.
Yeah.
There's a context to that. We didn't come out of nothing. I'm not making this decision in a vacuum, you know.
Yeah.
So I thought it was important to sort of address that as well through the show.
And you said about the international kind of side. Are you continuing to tour with it? I know that we're talking at the start of 2018 and you're doing a run in London. Is there more plans
yes.
for the UK and abroad?
So I'll be back in May to the Bush Theatre as part of Fertility Fest. And then I've just been to Cyprus 6 weeks ago with it, which was brilliant. And then I'm bringing it to Australia for an Australian tour to Melbourne Fringe and Sydney Fringe and hopefully Brisbane as well, and maybe a couple of other places, time dependent, in September. And then there's a few other things in the pipeline as well that I can't talk about just yet.
Can't reveal yet.
It's been really exciting, the amount of interest in the show and the way that it's resonating. I suppose this is in lots of ways a very global kind of universal issue at the moment, so it's resonating in lots of different places in the world, which is great.
Well, I mean, I've talked about this whole subject matter about women feeling more empowered, having the choice, but whether it is a good idea, because does it then make you reliant on the fact if you have frozen your eggs that that's going to be a definite outcome? And in fact, the conversation that I had before you and I are chatting now with Zeynep, who's an expert, talked about this whole issue that we have about the 10-year storage cutoff in the UK. So we're coming to the first time, because it was 10 years ago that women started freezing their eggs, that women who did freeze them are having to decide what they then do with them, because that's it, you can't put them anywhere after. So there's a lot of issues around this, and I think it's really interesting that there's so much more dialogue about it, and that people are kind of portraying it different ways to help others understand it, so that people don't just go, oh, go and freeze your eggs, or oh, don't worry about it, it'll happen. You know, when people make these generalized comments, when you have said you don't know yet, or you might not want to have a family or what have you, hopefully it helps with the awareness, and I'm sure some of the feedback that you've had has proved that.
No, absolutely. I mean, when in the course of my research, I don't know, maybe there's more advanced technology for this in the UK and elsewhere, but certainly in Ireland, by the time I had made the play, there hadn't been one successful pregnancy, or one successful birth, rather, from a frozen egg. There has been one now since last year, but only one, as far as I'm aware, and lots of the obstetricians that I spoke to and people who ran clinics felt it would be unethical to even offer it as a service, because at the point that we were at in terms of the quality of egg freezing and stuff was that it, you know, by no means was it, you know, it was very unlikely to have a successful outcome, and they didn't feel that they could offer it for those reasons. So it was, yeah, I mean, they felt that it was offering people a false hope.
Because I know there have been changes in the way that eggs are frozen, so maybe that was the old method. I don't know.
I know there's just been one successful pregnancy so far, but that's in Ireland. I know there's been others internationally,
Well, it is a very fascinating kind of subject matter, and I wish you the best of luck. And I will be at Fertility Fest. So I look forward to meeting you there, and we'll be doing more on the podcast about all the brilliant stuff that happens at Fertility Fest. So I look forward to seeing the play, because I was going to ask whether you're coming up to Manchester, but I'll get to see it there, which is great.
Oh, fantastic. Well, look forward to meeting you. Thanks so much for having me on, Natalie.
Pleasure, and enjoy your run in London.
Yes, we're running from the 30th of January until the 3rd of February. And there's two shows on the 3rd, one a matinee at 3:30 and an evening show at 8 o'clock.
Well, I'll put the link to the theatre in the show notes. And if you are listening to this as it's come out at the end of January, then you are in the UK, you've got time to see Joanne's play. Or even if you're not, you might want to hop on a plane if you're desperate to see it and can't wait till she gets to Australia. So I will put all the details, and enjoy and good luck. Thank you, Joanne.
Brilliant. Thanks so much, Natalie. Take care.
Right. Bye. So Joanne Ryan there, talking about her play Existentialism, and all the details of how you can see her will be in the show notes, as well as where the show is touring around the world. And the show notes for this episode are thefertilitypodcast.com/10, the number 10. Okay, so go and have a look at the show notes. And whilst you're at thefertilitypodcast.com, there's a number of things you can do. You can find out all my social media channels, Instagram, Twitter, and the new Facebook group that I've launched called Talk Fertility, which is dead easy to find on Facebook. But I'm urging you to sign up to the newsletter there, because one thing that I'm going to be doing in 2018 is taking this podcast live, initially around the UK. So if you would be interested in coming to a live podcast session and have the chance to talk to me and talk to some experts that I will be speaking to, then get in touch. Let me know where you're at, location-wise, and whether you'd be interested. So just drop me an email, natalie@thefertilitypodcast.com, or let me know on the different social media channels that you choose to follow, because I will be talking about this on there as well. And then I'll be keeping you updated on my newsletter. If you just do one thing, that is sign up for my newsletter, then I'll be able to remind you of this and keep in touch with you about what's going to be happening. So exciting. The first one is going to be in March, all right, in Manchester, which is where I'm based. So keep a note of the 24th of March in your diaries if you're in Manchester. Sign up for the newsletter. I'll keep posted, all right? And until the next time,